Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with David Gergen, Senior Political Analyst for CNN. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at an app that enables users to exchange STD information. And we begin with this week's Bright Idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
It's a well-known fact. Americans have an obesity problem. Close to a third of us are obese, 30 pounds or more over our ideal weight, and another third of the nation fits the overweight category, and the toll on the nation's health can't be overstated. But healthcare providers across the country are hard-pressed to tackle this problem, which is unlikely to be solved in the exam room. Dr. Bonnie Spring teaches preventive care at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, and she just completed a study that looks at the efficacy of a mobile phone weight loss app and how it might aid clinicians and patients in this quest to lose weight and keep it off.
So what we wanted to do was to see if we could come into an existing system of care and introduce an app that could boost the weight loss outcomes that they were getting from their existing system.
100 participants spent a year in the study in which all were required to record the food they ate, the amount of daily exercise they logged, as well as to attend weight loss support groups. And those who were also given access to the weight loss app, in addition to regular phone check-ins with a health coach, saw better results.
It's that they would get immediate feedback on how they were meeting their calorie and activity goals. They would have decision support to give them just-in-time feedback to make choices in the moment. And the information was being uploaded to a coach who actually didn't do all that much. They talked to them for 10 minutes every couple of weeks. But the patients knew that the coach was tracking.
Dr. Spring said the weight loss success seems to be supported by the higher degree of accountability that the app gave the participants. Their health coach was being fed real data on a regular basis, and that increased the participants' accountability too. She says the app alone or the group meetings alone yielded far less weight loss success.
And it's also that everybody is then doing a part and their appropriate part, that the physician is doing the referral and saying this is important, the allied health professional is doing the health education, and the patient is doing their part, tracking their behavior and using an app that helps them do that.
The app they developed for the study, called Engage, is not available on the market yet, but Dr. Spring feels that this and apps like it that are already on the market can be useful tools to assist clinicians who are trying to help their patients win the battle of the bulge.
This is the future of healthcare, that it's accessible, it's convenient, and it's also technology supported. If you think about the comparison to having to come for in-person visits, that can be quite burdensome and quite daunting for many people.
A mobile phone app that connects people trying to lose weight to a health coach who regularly monitors their progress and encourages them, thus inspiring more weight loss success? Now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with David Gergen, Senior Political Analyst for CNN and Director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard Kennedy School. Mr. Gergen served in the administration of four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He also serves on the board of several philanthropic organizations. He's got his undergraduate from Yale University and also graduated from Harvard Law School. He's the recipient of 22 honorary degrees and author of the bestseller, Witness to Power. David Gergen, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You know, you've been front and center in the world of politics for over 40 years, and you've watched other presidents fail at attempts to reform healthcare and provide universal access in this country. And we've just come through quite a contentious election cycle and are now equally divisive battle over the so-called fiscal cliff. But can you frame up for the public the impact that the Affordable Care Act has? Maybe give us your assessment. I think you've called it both a triumph and a tragedy. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, in my judgment, it was a triumph and a tragedy, a triumph in this sense that seven presidents since World War II have tried to pass legislation guaranteeing universal access to health care insurance, and all seven failed. I worked for two of them, Richard Nixon way back in the 70s, who came very close to cutting the deal with Teddy Kennedy, and Kennedy said later in his life that one of his greatest regrets was not forging that bipartisan agreement back way back when, but there we are. And then again, I worked for President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton as they tried to get health care through, and of course that, even with the Democratic Congress, that did not get out of committee. So, so there's been a lot of failures on this front, and Barack Obama deserves credit for, as historically, as the president who actually got it passed. And it was not easy, but he did get it passed, and, we can now talk about sort of where we go from here. But I think this is going to be one of his most important legacies, and the reason that so many people around him were anxious that he be reelected was in order to protect the Affordable Health Care Act mm-hmm. in the future, and I think that they succeeded in that. At the same time, I would say that this was a tragedy in a sense. It was a political tragedy. And I go back to the days when I was I joined the Clinton White House in midway the first year when they were developing their health care proposal. And at that time, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the senator, was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and he has and remains for me both an iconic figure as well. He was both a friend and a mentor mm-hmm. over the years, and I miss him today. Mm-hmm. But he pulled me aside more than once during that first Clinton year to say, David, whatever happens, we must ensure that this is a bipartisan bill, that it passed with bipartisan support. He said that if you look back over history, the great social milestones of contemporary American history have been bills that have passed with supermajorities, pointing all the way back to Social Security in the mid-30s and coming forward to Medicare, Medicaid in 1965, to the Civil Rights I, Civil Rights II in the mid-60s, all the way up to tax reform in 1986. And he said, the reason you want to go bipartisan, it takes the issue off the table. So in effect, it says to everybody, we've settled this issue, now let's move on to other problems. And the tragedy in the case of the Affordable Health Care Act is that in passing it, it was passed with only the votes of one party, the Democratic Party. And it, as a result, it has become a political football. It was obviously a central issue in this past presidential campaign, but it's going to continue to be opposed in a variety of ways, whether through lawsuits or through how the exchanges are set up or a variety of different things we'll see, because it wasn't settled. If we had had both parties agree to it, if they'd been able to work out a compromise that both parties could agree to, I think we would have been far better off.
Well, David, I don't think there's anyone who would disagree that it's a tragedy that there wasn't a bipartisan support, and yet it seemed that there was, in fact, no alternate plan that was being proposed to which people could meld into this legislation that we were so polarized. And I wonder if it's all speculation at this point or it's, what might have been. But were there elements that you thought were offered by the Republicans or by the conservatives that would have made this a better bill that you wish had been included in the final legislation?
I think that the reason it wasn't bipartisan was I don't think the people who negotiated it, not all of them were doing it in good faith. The president had a Democratic Congress, but he also had, he controlled the Congress, but he also had significant Republican opposition in every form. And there were clearly people on the Republican side who didn't want this, anything like this to pass, who did not believe that this was the right way to go for the country. And part of it was that it was Obama, had his name on it. For example, the mandates. The idea of mandates started, as President Obama has said several times, found its home in the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative organization, as you know. And yet, when Obama proposed it, it suddenly became anathema. So there are legitimate arguments on the side of the Democrats that there were people who, on the Republican side, who just didn't want to vote for it because they had Obama's name on it. But I must tell you that I think that there were some legitimate concerns and there's some legitimate criticisms coming from the right. For example, we had the meeting at Blair House, in which there were a variety of discussions. That meeting should have occurred far earlier in the process if you truly wanted to have a bipartisan conversation. And B, the Republicans did put some ideas on the table. Lamar Alexander, senator from Tennessee, put a number of ideas on the table. And I think it's fair to say that there was no heed paid to those ideas. I think the Republicans would have been more open to compromise had there been something done on malpractice. They believe that's one of the driving forces behind the cost of health care. And yet we know the Democrats are very beholden to the trial lawyers. you know, that's politics. So could they have worked out a compromise? You know, I think there's a legitimate question whether it was possible. But I also think neither side tried as hard as they might have.
Mm-hmm. David, we are moving from the frying pan of the election into the fire of debt reduction negotiations.
Sure.
And prior to the elections, I think you were critical of the Republican Party in terms of their obstructionism. Post-election, you've been focused in on the heavy-handedness of the Democrats and how they're managing this. So now we're looking at the tough reality in 2013, a new year in which there must be some meaningful compromise to address the deficit. Can you give us your wisdom on the compromise that will be both good politics and good for the country?
I do think there's a deal to be done, and I think people of goodwill could do it. I actually think if you put 10 governors in a room with some of the leading mayors in the country and put equal numbers from both sides in the room, they would come up with a deal within 24 hours. Because governors and mayors tend to be people who mm-hmm. have to solve problems. And I've noticed that they're on education reform, for example, you find across party lines a lot more agreement than disagreement among some leading governors. You know, Washington is a place of dysfunctionality and posturing to a remarkable degree now, and it's really hurt our politics. And now we can talk about who's being heavy-handed and who's not. But let's go to the question of, is there a deal? What would the deal look like? I don't think there's any question that the central element of a deal would be revenue increases, partly based on tax rates, that are accompanied by a couple of, at least two changes, and that's one's going to be in the, I think, two changes in Medicare that are pretty obviously on the table, and President Obama, who was willing to consider last year, one would be a change in the Medicare age of eligibility. The other would be on means testing, so that the wealthy would pay more in effect or have less benefits. I think the president also was willing to consider last year was something which is very important, and that is how you measure the inflation index for Social Security. There is some feeling that the index is overly generous in terms of it doesn't truly measure the costs of people. Now, all of these, I think, taken together, the components of a deal would primarily put the burden on the more affluent. And I think the president is right that the more affluent in this country can step up and pay a greater share. I would also wish that we would drop the rhetoric of attacking people who are successful as somehow villainous and just say, look, you know, we all have to do something here. We all have to sacrifice to some degree, but the more affluent are more able to do that. So I think the burden on taxes clearly is going to come from the upper income. And the burden on, in terms of entitlements, we ought to do it in a way that we protect people who are really needy.
David, your career really started very soon after the launch during the Great Society of Medicare and Medicaid. And it seems in previous campaigns and previous generations, we always heard a lot about Medicare, didn't hear so much about Medicaid. And yet in the more recent debates, Medicaid has moved to a much more central position. And I think one of the problems on many governors' plates to solve is the growth in their Medicaid budgets.
I'm not enough of an authority on exactly how delivery of health care services. Our daughter is a doctor, a family doctor, works in the Boston Medical Center, works with the underserved population, very tough problems, and I hear a lot from her about how difficult life is for people at the lower end of things. And so many of us are pretty far removed from that, and I think we should be very generous toward those who are needy. At the same time, I think there is no question that we have inefficiencies that are not necessary. The cost of disability is skyrocketing in this country. And, we've put more people on disability since the recession ended than we have into jobs. There is something fishy about that. There is something that raises questions about how many people are gaming the system? And we don't know the answer to that question, but I think it deserves consideration because we have limited resources, and they ought to be devoted to the people who truly need them. And we ought to find ways to cut back on benefits we've promised to those who really don't need them. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's worth talking about the tax deduction system. In order to pay for health care for the needy, we ought to look at, do we really need to give tax deductions to people who buy super houses and get $1 million plus mortgage? And I happen to be in the more affluent group, and I don't see how to justify that. I don't think there are enough incentives in Obamacare for healthy living. The Republicans also put that idea on the table that if you have health insurance and you live a balanced life and eat in a nutritiously good way, you exercise, and you can keep your health care costs down, you ought to get some benefit from that. Mm-hmm. I think it's crazy to think that any time we try to touch Medicare or Medicaid, that somehow that's anti-poor, or that's anti, you're insensitive, inhumane, and that sort of thing. I do think that there are serious ways that we, you know, I look at what the bipartisan center did with Alice Rivlin as a co-chair of the committee with Pete Domenici. Alice Rivlin is a strong, strong Democrat who comes in and says, you know, we can make changes in these Medicare and Medicaid programs that will actually save money that are not necessary to protect the needy.
You know, I want to get back to one of the comments you made a little earlier about the ability to get governors and mayors in a room and that they have the capacity to get things done. Had me sort of thinking about the core skill sets that you need to govern in this country. And, you know, there's a whole sea change happening, not only in healthcare, but in technology, sort of transforming the way that people do business. And you're the head at the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. So what are you trying to impart in these new leaders about the core skill sets that they need to lead our country through all the disruptive changes and forces that are going on at this time?
That's a good question. And we wrestle with that regularly, and it's not always clear what skill set you need. Clearly, though, I think it's very true that to be in the future, one is going to have a wide bandwidth, that you need to be well-educated, well-schooled, well-trained in a particular area so you've got depth. Increasingly, leaders are called upon to make decisions across a wide spectrum of issues and complexities. You have to learn how to live, to work in partnership with other leaders. In days gone past, you could be the leader of your own organization. Today, in order to get synergy or leverage, you really have to work with the leaders of other, if you're in the nonprofit sector, for example. I've just come back from New Orleans, where we had a conference on with leading education reformers in the K-12 area, as well as leading philanthropists like Eli Broad and Wendy Kopp of Teach for America. I'm on the board for Teach for America. And she called this gathering, and it was very clear that among the education reformers, many of whom are in the nonprofit sector, that they get a lot more bang if they work together, not only within the organization, but across organizations, and if they reinforce each other, if you, in effect, create an ecosystem. So that Teach for America may provide teachers, but there's new leaders for new schools. We help provide principals. You've got groups that, like City Year that try to work on this dropout rate. There are an array of things that have to be done, and good leaders have to, you know, work on across systems, and they have to work, you know, frankly, a growing number of people that coming out of these good schools are going to have to learn how to work across sectors. They're going to spend part of their lives in the private sector, but they're very likely to spend a chunk of their lives in the nonprofit and in the governmental sector. And it's important to understand that. We've got to internationalize them. They've got to understand how to deal with the new internet world. But, you know, most of all, very importantly, it's a question of creating a culture. A culture in which we see we're all in this together, and that it's one for all and all for one. We had a visitor here on our campus last night with a group of our students who was a man of 41 years old, and he has just come back. He graduated from Holy Cross in mathematics. His name is Mike Hayes, and he went on to go in to join the Navy SEAL some 19 years ago. And he was became a White House fellow. He's worked in the White House as in the national security area in high-level positions for both Republicans and Democrats. And then he went back into the Navy SEALs, and he just came back from Afghanistan, where he was in charge of 2,000 people. Now, he brought his men back alive. And the way they brought their men back alive, and they had no civilian casualties, you know, on the Afghan side. It was they had a huge amount of discipline. They had enormous amount of dedication to each other and to the common cause. And you can't rule. You can't lead by regulation and rules. You have to persuade. You have to mobilize people through a belief in a common effort. And I think we can do that in the healthcare field. One of the things I'm encouraged about in the healthcare field enormously about where we go from here is that the younger generation of doctors, and I say this partly because of my daughter, is the new generation of doctors coming up. They're not in it for the money. They're not in it fee for service. They're happy to take. They're happy to take a salary, and they're happy to work collaboratively. That kind of change in medicine, working toward accountable care organizations, can bring a lot of reductions in costs as well as an increase in wellness. Catherine, our daughter, finds that in working with poor families, she's achieving a lot by working with groups so that you've got young expectant mothers who don't come in one by one. They'd have one by one attention if they need it. But they come in and have a support group up to over 15. They meet once a week. They spend a lot of time bonding and trying to help understand each other's problems and supporting each other. And it's a much more satisfying way to practice medicine. And by the way, it gets good results. So I think the younger generation is much more innovative than those of us who are older, and we'll find solutions to this. But we have to build a culture in which people like doctors are set up as like, wow, that's a wonderful thing to be doing. But also the pharmaceutical companies, they can do some good things here. They're very innovative. We don't need to just see them as greedy villains in all of this piece. I was just with the health insurance community. There are a lot of people that are trying hard to get this system to work. And I think it's best done by yelling and screaming at each other, by encouraging the best in each other.
We've been speaking today with David Gergen, senior political analyst for CNN, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School, and an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. You can find out more about Mr. Gergen's impressive contributions by going to davidgergen.com. David, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you both.
I'm Arianna Hare with this tech report. 50% of Americans have or have had an STD in their lifetime, and those numbers are generally amped up during the college years. The sad truth is, how many frisky folks in the blush of new romance stop to inquire about a person's STD status?
Let's talk about sex, baby.
Some doctors have partnered up to create what they hope will be a useful tool in the mating rituals of Generation Text. Dr. Michael Nussbaum and his partners first created MedX. It's a phone app that allows folks to have access to all their medical records and allow them to link that information between all of their care providers.
And really, it was designed to improve communication and empower patients to take charge of their healthcare information.
Part of a growing trend. So getting back to those sexually transmitted diseases, they thought the number suggested a new weapon was needed.
So 50% of all Americans have either had an STD or have an STD at some point in their lives.
And an estimated 40% of American college students have STDs, and many of whom don't know it. And that's how they're spread. So they developed an app for their MedX program called SafeBump, where a person can easily share confirmation that they've been recently tested for STDs and they've been cleared by their doctor.
So basically what happens is you go to your college health clinic or you go to your medical doctor and they test you for STDs. And when you're cleared, they give you a clearance on the system. It never says that you're positive. In fact, there's no way to know if you're positive versus you've never been tested. All it does is give you a clearance.
So you're at a frat party out in the town, you meet someone you like, and if they have the same app on their phone, you safe bump their phones.
You can bump and you bump your phones, and what it does is it allows you to exchange information. So it says that, you know, Mary Smith would like to exchange information with you, and it gives you the option to select your telephone number, your email address, your picture, or your STD status. You can do all of them, you can do none of them, you can do one of them, and then that exchanges the information with the individual you just bump phones with.
Dr. Nussbaum says a lot of STDs are dormant, and a person doesn't know they're in trouble until they try one day to conceive.
Infertility is a real problem as a result of STDs.
Dr. Nussbaum says this program would also be great help to the middle-aged and older dating population where STDs are also a rampant problem. The products are on the marketplace, but he realizes getting people to adopt the safe bump technology is going to take some time. I'm Arianna O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.